You could say everything by letter. Everything, except whatever he did not want them to know, such as the string of bastards that was springing up behind him as if by magic. It seemed that no sooner did he roll in the pasture with a girl than she became pregnant. It had to be the work of the devil. No one had ever seen such astonishing fertility, and he was sure that at least half the infants were not his. That was why he decided that aside from Pancha Garcia's son, who was called Esteban like himself, and whose mother was definitely a virgin when he had possessed her, the rest of them might or might not be his. It was always better to think that they were not. Whenever a woman showed up at his door with a newborn baby in her arms, asking for his surname or some other form of assistance, he would send her on her way with a few banknotes pressed into her hand and the warning that if she ever bothered him again, he would send her flying with his whip, so that she would be cured of any wish to wiggle her tail at the first man she saw and then come accusing him. This was why he never knew the exact number of his children, and the fact of the matter was that he was not interested. He figured that when he was ready to have children, he would find a woman of his own class with the blessings of the church, because the only ones who really counted were the ones who bore their father's surname. The others might just as well not have been born. And he would have none of that monstrous talk about everyone being born with the same rights and inheriting equally, because if that happened, everybody would go to hell and civilization would be thrown back to the Stone Age. He remembered Nivea, Rosa's mother, who after her husband had retired from politics, terrified by the poison brandy, had begun her own political campaign. She would chain herself with other ladies to the gates of Congress and the Supreme Court, setting off a degrading spectacle that made all their husbands look ridiculous. He knew that Nivea went out at night to hang suffragette posters on walls across the city, and that she was capable of walking through the heart of the city in the plain light of day with a broom in her hand and a tri-cornered hat on her head, calling for women to have equal rights with men, to be allowed to vote and attend the university, and for all children, even bastards, to be granted the full protection of the law. "That woman is sick in the head," Trueba would proclaim. "It would go against nature. If women don't know that 2 and 2 are 4, how are they going to be able to handle a scalpel? Their duty is motherhood and the home. At the rate they're going, the next thing you know, they'll be asking to be deputies, judges, even president of the republic. And in the meantime, they're sowing confusion and disorder that could lead to disaster. They're printing obscene pamphlets, speaking on the radio, chaining themselves to public places till the police have to come with a blacksmith and cut them free. And they might even get arrested, which is what they should be. It's a crying shame that there's always some influential husband, some spineless judge or firebrand member of Congress to set them free. What these cases really need is a strong hand." The war in Europe had ended, and the railroad cars piled high with the dead were a distant clamor. Though it had not quieted down entirely, it was from there that subversive ideas were carried on the uncontrollable winds of the radio, the telegraph, and the steamers laden with immigrants who stepped ashore in a daze, fleeing the hunger back home, stunned by the roar of the bombs and the corpses rotting in the plowed fields. It was an election year, and there was reason for concern over the turn of events. The country was waking up. The wave of discontent that was stirring the people was beginning to strike at the heart of that oligarchic society. In the countryside that year, everything happened. Drought, snails, and hoof-and-mouth disease. There was unemployment in the north, and in the capital, the effects of the distant war were still being felt. It was a year of poverty, a year in which the only thing missing to complete the sense of disaster was an earthquake. The upper class, however, in whose hands were concentrated all the power and wealth, was unaware of the danger that threatened the fragile equilibrium of their position. The rich amuse themselves by dancing the Charleston and the new rhythms of jazz, the foxtrot, and some Negro cumbias that were marvelously indecent. Steamer crossings to Europe were resumed after being suspended during 4 years of war, and new routes, this time to North America, became the rage. Golf was a novelty, bringing the cream of society together around a tiny ball that was struck with a stick, just as the Indians had done 200 years before in these same places. The ladies wore long strings of cultured pearls that hung down to their knees, and crochet hats that hid their eyebrows. They cut their hair like men, made themselves up to look like prostitutes, stopped wearing corsets, and smoked like chimneys. The men were in a state of shock from the American automobiles, which arrived in the country in the morning and were sold by afternoon, despite the fact that they cost a small fortune and were hardly more than an explosion of smoke and clanking screws flying at a suicidal rate along roads that had been built for horses and other natural beasts, and most certainly not for these products of the imagination. Whole inheritances were played at gambling tables, along with the easy fortunes of the post-war years. Champagne was uncorked, and cocaine was introduced for the more wicked and refined. The collective madness looked as if it would never end. But in the countryside, the new automobiles were as unreal as short dresses, and those who were just emerging from the invasion of snails and hoof-and-mouth disease simply viewed it as a good year. Esteban Trueba and the other landowners in the area gathered in their club to plan political strategy for the upcoming presidential elections. The peasants were still living exactly as they had in colonial times and had not heard of unions or Sundays off or the minimum wage. But now delegates from the new formed parties of the left, disguised as evangelicals, were beginning to infiltrate the haciendas with a Bible tucked under one armpit and Marxist pamphlets under the other, simultaneously preaching the abstemious life and revolution or death. Those conspiratorial lunches of the patrones would culminate in either Romanesque debauchery or cockfights, and by evening the men would take the Red Lantern by storm, where 12-year-old prostitutes and Carmelo, the only homosexual in the brothel and the town, would dance to the strains of an antediluvian victrola beneath the watchful eye of Sophia, who was too old to go chasing around herself, although she still had the energy to run her business with an iron hand and keep the police from barging in and the customers from taking liberties with the girls, screwing them and then refusing to pay. Of all of them, the one who danced the best was Tránsito Soto, who was also best at resisting the drunk men's attacks. She was indefatigable and never complained. It was as if she had the Tibetan gift of placing her skinny adolescent frame in her client's hands and transporting her soul to some distant place. Esteban Trueba liked her because she was not squeamish about new ideas and the brutalities of love, sang with the voice of a hoarse bird, and had once told him she was going to go far in life, and he had found that amusing. "I'm not going to spend my life in the Red Lantern," she had said. "I'm going to the capital because I want to be rich and famous." Esteban went to the brothel, as it was the only source of entertainment in the town, but he was not a man for whores. He did not like to pay for something he could get by other means. Still, he enjoyed spending time with Tránsito Soto. She made him laugh. One day, after making love, he was in a generous mood, something that hardly ever happened, and he asked Tránsito Soto if she would like him to give her a present. "Lend me 50 pesos, she requested instantly.
"That's a lot of money. Why so much?"
"For a train ticket, a red dress, high-heeled shoes, a bottle of perfume, and a permanent. That's everything I need to start. I'll pay you back someday. With interest." Esteban gave her the 50 pesos, because that morning he had sold 5 bulls and his pockets were full of bills, and also because the exhaustion of pleasure made him rather sentimental.
I'm only sorry that I won't be seeing you again, Tránsito. I've grown accustomed to you.
But we will see each other, Patrón. Life is long and full of unexpected turns. The immense meals in the club, the cockfights, and the afternoons in the brothel all culminated in a clever, although by no means original, plan for making sure that the peasants exercised their right to vote. The patrones threw them a big party with empanadas and lots of wine, barbecued a few cows specially slaughtered for the occasion, serenaded them with songs accompanied on the guitar, beat them over the head with a few political harangues, and promised them that if the conservative candidate won the election, they would all receive a bonus, but that if he lost, they would lose their jobs. In addition, they rigged the ballot boxes and bribed the police. At the end of the party, they piled the peasants onto wooden carts and hauled them off to vote, under careful observation, amidst much joking and laughter. It was the one time in their lives they showed the peasants a trace of intimacy. Pal this and pal that. Don't worry, patron. I'm on your team. You can count on me. That's the way I like it. Pal, it's nice to see you have a patriotic conscience. You know the liberals and radicals are all a bunch of morons, and the communists are atheist bastards who eat little children. On the day of the election, everything went according to plan, in perfect order. The armed forces were there to uphold the democratic process, and all was peaceful on a spring day more sprightly and sunny than usual. An example for this continent of Indians and Negroes who spend their time making revolutions to overthrow one dictator and install another. This is a different country. This country's a genuine republic. We have civic pride. Here the Conservative Party wins cleanly and openly. And we don't need a general to keep things orderly and calm, not like the neighboring dictatorships where they kill each other off while the gringos walk away with all their raw materials, Trueba declared in the club dining room, raising his wine glass to offer a toast when the results of the elections were announced. 3 days later, when things were back to normal, a letter from Férula arrived at Tres Marias. The night before, Esteban Trueba had dreamt of Rosa. It had been a long time since that had happened. In the dream, she had appeared with her weeping willow hair hanging over her shoulders, like a botanical mantle that covered her down to her waist. Her skin was hard and cold, the color and texture of alabaster. She was naked, and held a bundle in her arms, and she walked as people do in dreams, with the shimmering green halo floating around her body. He saw her coming slowly toward him, and when he reached out to touch her, she hurled her package to the ground, shattering its contents at his feet. He knelt down and picked it up. It was a tiny girl without eyes, and she was calling him Papa. He awoke in a state of anxiety and was grumpy all morning. Because of the dream, he was already uneasy, long before Férula's letter was delivered. As he did every morning, he went into the kitchen for his breakfast and saw a hen pecking crumbs from the floor. He gave it a kick that ripped its stomach open, leaving it to die in a pool of guts and feathers, flapping its wings. Instead of calming him down, this only increased his irritation, and he felt as if he were choking. He climbed up on his horse and galloped off to supervise the livestock that were being branded. He stopped first at the house of Pedro Segundo Garcia, who had gone to the station in San Lucas to leave off a parcel and had passed through town to pick up the mail. Pedro had returned with Férula's letter. The envelope lay all morning on the table in the entrance hall. When Esteban Trueba arrived home, he went straight in to take a bath. He was covered with sweat and dust and saturated with the unmistakable odor of frightened beasts. Only later did he sit down at his desk to do his accounts and order a meal brought in to him on a tray. He did not look at his sister's letter until nighttime, when he checked the house, as was his custom before going to bed, to be sure that all the lights were extinguished and all the doors were locked. Ferula's letter looked like all the others she had sent him, but even before opening it, he knew, as he held it in his hand, that its contents would change his life. He felt exactly as he had years earlier when he held his sister's telegram informing him of Rosa's death. He opened it, his temples pulsing with foreboding. The letter said briefly that Doña Esther Trueba was dying, and that after so many years of taking care of her and waiting on her hand and foot, Ferula now had to suffer with the torment of her mother not recognizing her and calling day and night for her son Esteban, because she did not want to die without seeing him. Esteban had never really loved his mother or felt at ease in her presence, but the news shook him nonetheless. He understood that the excuses he had always made to avoid seeing her would not avail him now, and that the time had come for him to travel to the capital and face for the last time this woman who was always present in his nightmares, with her rancid smell of medicine, her frail moans, and her interminable prayers, this suffering woman who had peopled his childhood with prohibitions and terrors and weighed his manhood with responsibilities and guilt. He summoned Pedro Segundo Garcia and explained the situation. He led him to the desk and showed him the ledgers and accounts of the general store. He handed him a bunch of keys with all except the key to his wine cellar, and announced that from that moment till the day he returned, Pedro would be responsible for everything that happened in Tres Marias, and that he would pay dearly for any mishaps that occurred. Pedro Segundo Garcia took the keys, tucked the ledgers under his arm, and smiled without a trace of happiness. "One does one's best, patron," he said, shrugging his shoulders. The next day, for the first time in years, Esteban Trueba retraced the steps that had led him from his mother's house to the countryside. An ox cart took him and his suitcases as far as the station in San Lucas, where he took the first-class coach from the days of the British Railway and crossed once more the vast fields that lay at the feet of the Cordillera. He closed his eyes and tried to sleep, but the image of his mother haunted his dreams. 3. Clara, the Clairvoyant. Clara was 10 years old when she decided that speaking was pointless and locked herself in silence. Her life changed markedly. Fat, kindly Dr. Cuevas attempted to treat her with pills of his own devising, with vitamins and syrup and throat swabbings with borax honey, but all to no apparent effect. He soon realized that his remedies were useless and that his very presence induced a state of terror in the child. Whenever she saw him, Clara would begin to shriek, running for refuge to the farthest corner of the house, where she would huddle like a frightened animal. So he abandoned his treatments and suggested that Severo and Nivea take her to see a Romanian named Rostipov, who was causing quite a sensation that season. Rostipov made his living as a magician in vaudeville shows and had achieved the incredible feat of stringing a wire from the pinnacle of the cathedral to the cupola of the Galician Brotherhood on the other side of the plaza, which he walked across with only a frail stick for balance. Despite his more frivolous side, Rostipov had caused an uproar in scientific circles because he spent his free time curing hysteria with magic wands and hypnotic trances. Nivea and Severo took Clara to the consulting room that the Romanian had improvised in his hotel. Rostipov carefully examined her. When he had finished, he declared that her case was not within his province to cure. Since the child was silent, because she did not feel like speaking, not because she was unable to. Nevertheless, at her parents' insistence, He concocted some lilac-colored sugar pills, which he prescribed with the warning that they were a Siberian remedy for deaf mutes. But in this case, the power of suggestion failed, and the second bottle of pills was swallowed by Barrabás in a moment of oversight that fortunately had no appreciable results. Severo and Nivea attempted to make her speak with household remedies, threatening and cajoling, and even refusing to let her eat, to see if hunger would force her to open her mouth to ask for food. But that, too, was to no avail. Nana had the idea that a good fright might make the child speak, and spent 9 years inventing all sorts of desperate strategies for frightening Clara, the end result of which was to immunize the girl forever against terror and surprise. Soon, Clara was afraid of nothing. She was unmoved by the sudden appearance of the most livid and undernourished monsters in her room, or by the knock of devils and vampires at her bedroom window. Nana dressed up as a headless pirate, as the executioner of the Tower of London, as a werewolf or a horned devil, depending on her inspiration of the moment and on the ideas she got while flipping through the pages of certain horror magazines, which she bought for this purpose and from which, although she was unable to read, she copied the illustrations. She had acquired the habit of gliding silently through the hallways and jumping at the child in the dark, howling through the doorways, and hiding live animals between her sheets. But none of this elicited so much as a peep from the little girl. At times, Glada lost her patience. She would throw herself on the floor, kicking and shouting, but without pronouncing a single word in any recognizable tongue. Or she would scrawl on the tiny blackboard that never left her side, setting down the worst insults she could think of to say to the poor woman, who would weep disconsolately in the kitchen. "It's for your own good, my little angel," Nana would sob, wrapped in a bloody sheet, her face blackened with burnt cork. Nivea forbade her to continue frightening her daughter. She realized that the tension in the air increased Clara's mental powers and disturbed the spirits that were hovering around the child. Besides, that procession of terrifying figures was destroying Barrabás's nervous system. He had never had a well-developed sense of smell, and was incapable of recognizing Nana beneath her multiple disguises. The dog would begin to urinate on himself sitting down, leaving an immense puddle all around him, and frequently his teeth would chatter. But Nana took advantage of the slightest distraction on Nivea's part to persist in her attempts to cure the child's muteness with the same remedy she used for hiccups. Clara was removed from the convent school at which all the Del Valle sisters had been educated and placed under the instruction of private tutors who came to the house. Severo brought in a special governess from England, Miss Agatha, who was tall and amber-colored, and had the large hands of a bricklayer, but she was no match for the climate, the spicy food, and the independent flights of the salt shaker across the dining room table, and was forced to return to Liverpool. The next one was a Swiss girl, who fared no better, and then a French one, who arrived courtesy of the family's acquaintance with the ambassador of that country. But she was so rosy, round, and sweet that within a few short months she was with child. A brief investigation revealed the father to be Luis, Clara's older brother. Without asking their opinion, Severo made them marry, and despite the predictions to the contrary of Nivea and her friends, they were very happy. After all these experiences, Nivea convinced her husband that the study of foreign languages was not important for a child with telepathic gifts, and that it would be far better for her to continue piano lessons and to learn how to sew. Little Clara read all the time. Her interest in books was indiscriminate. She was as happy to read the magic books from her Uncle Marcos's enchanted trunks as she was to contemplate the Liberal Party documents her father kept in his study. She filled innumerable notebooks with her private observations, recording the events of those years, thanks to which they were not erased by the mists of forgetfulness, and I can now use them to reclaim her memory. Clara, the clairvoyant, could interpret dreams. It was an inborn talent, requiring none of the trying Kabbalistic study to which her uncle Marcos had applied himself with far more effort and far less effect. The first one to realize this was Honorio, the gardener, who dreamt one night that there were snakes between his toes and that in order to get rid of them, he had kicked and kicked until he had squashed 19. He told this to the little girl while he was pruning the rose bushes, simply to entertain her, because he adored her, and it made him sad that she was mute. Clara took out her slate from her apron pocket and wrote down her interpretation of Honorio's dream. You will have a lot of money. It will last only a short while. You will make it without effort. Play number 19. Honorio did not know how to read, but Nivea read the message out to him amid joking and laughter. The gardener did everything Clara told him to do and won 80 pesos in an illegal numbers game that was held behind a coal store. He spent it on a new suit, an unforgettable drinking spree with all his friends, and a porcelain doll for Clara. From that day on, the child had more work than she could handle deciphering dreams behind her mother's back, for once Honorio's story made the rounds, she was pursued by questions. What does it mean to fly above a tower with swan's wings? To float out to sea on a raft and hear sirens with a widow's voice? For someone to give birth to twins joined at the shoulder, each with a sword in his hand? And Clara would unhesitatingly write down on her little slate that the tower is death and whoever flies over it will be saved from an accidental death, that whoever is shipwrecked and hears the voice of a siren will lose his job and undergo great suffering, but he will be rescued by a woman with whom he will open a business, and that the twins are a husband and wife forced to share a single destiny, perpetually wounding one another with the blows of their swords. Dreams were not the only thing that Clara read. She could also predict the future and recognize people's intentions, abilities that she maintained throughout her life and that increased with time. She announced the death of her godfather, Don Salomon Valdez, a broker at the stock exchange, who, convinced that he had lost everything he owned, hanged himself from the chandelier in his elegant office. There they found him, at Clara's insistence, looking every bit like a dejected sheep, exactly as she had described him on her slate. She predicted her father's hernia, all the earthquakes and other natural disturbances, the one and only time snow fell in the capital, freezing to death the poor people in their shanty towns, and the rose bushes in the gardens of the rich, and the identity of the murderer of schoolgirls long before the police discovered the second corpse. But no one believed her, and Severo did not want her giving her opinion on matters concerning criminals who were not related to the family. With a single glance, Clara realized that Getulio Armando was going to swindle her father in the business of the Australian sheep, because she read it in the color of his aura. She wrote it to her father, but he did not pay attention, and by the time he remembered her prediction, he had already lost half of his fortune, and his partner was off in the Caribbean, newly wealthy, with a harem of big-bottomed mulatas and his own private boat for sunbathing. Clara's ability to move objects without touching them did not disappear with the onset of menstruation, as Nana had predicted, but rather became more pronounced, until she was so accomplished that she could move the keys on the piano with the cover down, even though she never learned to move the instrument itself around the drawing room as she wanted to. She spent the main part of her time and energy in these extravagant pursuits. She developed the capacity to guess an astonishing percentage of the cards in a deck, and invented games of fantasy to play with her brothers and sisters. Her father forbade her to read the future in cards, and to invoke ghosts and mischievous spirits that annoyed the rest of the family and terrorized the servants. But Nivea understood that the more limitations and shocks her daughter was subjected to, the madder she became, and decided to leave her in peace with her spiritualist tricks, her fortune-telling games, and her cavernous silence, and did her best to love her unconditionally and accept her as she was. Clara grew like a wild plant, despite the recommendations of Dr. Cuevas, who had brought from Europe the novel idea of cold baths and electric shocks for the treatment of the insane. Barrabás accompanied the child day and night, except during the normal periods of his sexual activity. He was always hovering around her like a gigantic shadow, as silent as the little girl herself. He threw himself at her feet when she sat down, and slept beside her every night, chugging like a locomotive. He became so attached to his mistress that when she sleepwalked through the house, the dog followed, imitating her posture. Whenever there was a full moon, they could be seen gliding down the corridors like two ghosts floating through the pale light. As the dog grew in size, his distractedness became more evident. He never comprehended, for example, the transparent nature of glass, and in moments of great emotion, he would charge the windows at a gallop with the innocent intention of catching a fly. He would fall through to the other side in a din of breaking glass, surprised and disappointed. In those days, window panes were brought from France by ship, and the animal's mania for crashing into them became a problem, until Clara thought of painting cats on the glass. When Barrabás became an adult, he stopped fornicating with the feet of the piano, as he had in his childhood, and his reproductive instinct declared itself only when he sniffed a bitch in heat in his close environs. On such occasions, there was neither chain nor door that could hold him back. He would hurl himself onto the street, overcoming every obstacle in his path, and remain at large for 2 or 3 days. He always returned with the poor dog hanging off him, suspended in the air, impaled on his immense masculinity. The children had to be whisked out of the way so they would not see the horrendous spectacle of the gardener hosing the dogs down with freezing water until, many gallons and kicks and other indignities later, Barrabás became unstuck from his beloved, leaving her to die in the courtyard of the house, where Severo was obliged to finish her off with a coup de grâce. Clara's adolescence passed calmly in her parents' large house with its 3 courtyards. She was spoiled to death by her older brothers, by Severo, who preferred her to all his other children, by Nivia, and by Nana, who alternated her sinister attacks disguised as a ghost with the most tender of attentions. Almost all her brothers and sisters had married or left, some to travel, others to work in the provinces, and the big house, which had contained such a large family, was almost empty, with many of its rooms locked. The child spent whatever free time her tutors left her in reading, moving numerous different objects without touching them, chasing Barrabás, practicing various techniques of prognostication, and learning to knit, which was the only one of the domestic arts she ever mastered. Ever since the Holy Thursday, on which Father Restrepo had accused her of being possessed, there had been a shadow over her head that the love of her parents and her siblings' discretion kept under control. Still, word of her unlikely talents circulated by whispers in gatherings of local ladies. Nivia realized that people never invited her daughter to their home, and that even her own cousins did everything they could to avoid her. She so successfully compensated for the lack of friends with her own total dedication, however, that Clara grew up happily, and in later years would recall her childhood as a luminous part of her existence, despite her solitude and muteness. All her life, she would remember the afternoons spent in the company of her mother in the sewing room, where Nivia sewed clothes for the poor on her machine and told stories and anecdotes about the family. She would point to the daguerreotypes on the wall and tell Clara of the past. "You see that serious man with a pirate's beard? That's your Uncle Mateo, who went to Brazil on some scheme that had to do with emeralds, but a fiery mulata gave him the evil eye. All his hair fell out, his nails dropped off, he lost his teeth, and he had to go see a sorcerer, a voodoo priest, a dark negro who gave him an amulet, and then his teeth grew back, his nails came out again, and he got back his hair. Look at him, Clara. He's hairier than an Indian. He was the only bald man in the world who ever got a second head of hair. Clara would smile without saying a word, and Nivea would go on talking because she had grown used to her daughter's silence. In addition, she nourished the hope that if she kept putting ideas into Clara's head, sooner or later she would ask a question and regain her speech. "And this," she would say, "is your Uncle Juan. I loved him very much. He once farted, and that became his death sentence, a great disgrace. It was during a picnic lunch. All my cousins and I were out together on the most fragrant spring afternoon, with our muslin dresses and our hats full of flowers and ribbons, and the boys were wearing their Sunday best. Juan took off his white jacket. Why? I can see him now. He rolled up his sleeves and swung gracefully from the branch of a tree, hoping that with his trapeze artist's skill, he could win the admiration of Constanza Andrade, the harvest queen, with whom, from the moment he laid eyes on her, he had been desperately in love. Juan did 2 impeccable push-ups and 1 complete somersault, but on his next flip over, he let go a loud burst of wind. Don't laugh, Clara. It was terrible. There was an embarrassed silence, and the harvest queen began to laugh uncontrollably. Juan put on his jacket and grew very pale. He walked slowly away from the group, and we never saw him again. They even looked for him in the Foreign Legion. They asked for him in all the consulates, but he was never heard of again. I think he must have become a missionary and gone to minister to the lepers out on Easter Island, which is as far away as a man can go to forget and be forgotten, because it's not on the normal routes of navigation and isn't even shown on Dutch maps. From that day on, he was referred to as Juan of the Fart. Nivea would take her daughter to the window and show her the dried-out trunk of the poplar tree. It was an enormous tree, she would say. I had it cut before my oldest son was born. They say it was so tall that you could see the whole city from its top, but the only one who got that high had no eyes to see it with. It was a tradition in the Del Valle family that when any of the young men wanted to wear long pants, he had to climb it to prove his valor. It was like an initiation rite. The tree was full of marks. I saw them with my own eyes when they knocked it down. From the first middle-sized branches, which were as thick as chimneys, you could already see the marks left by the grandfathers who had made the same ascent in their own youth. From the initials cut into the trunk, you could tell who had climbed higher, who was the bravest, as well as who had stopped, too terrified to continue. One day, it was the turn of Jerónimo, the blind cousin. He began the climb feeling his way up the branches without a moment's hesitation, for he couldn't see how high up he was and had no intuition of the void. He reached the top, but he wasn't able to complete the J of his initial because he came unstuck like a gargoyle and plummeted headfirst to the ground, landing at the feet of his father and brothers. He was 15 years old. They wrapped the body in a sheet and took it to his mother, who spat in all their faces and shouted at them with a sailor's insults and cursed the men who had induced her son to climb the tree, until finally the Sisters of Charity came to cart her off in a straitjacket. I knew that one day my sons would be expected to continue that barbarous tradition. That's why I had them cut it down. I didn't want Luis and the other children growing up in the shadow of that scaffold in the courtyard. At times, Clara would accompany her mother and 2 or 3 of her suffragette friends on their visits to factories, where they would stand on soapboxes and make speeches to the women who worked there, while the foremen and bosses, snickering and hostile, observed them from a prudent distance. Despite her tender age and complete ignorance of matters of this world, Clara grasped the absurdity of the situation and wrote in her notebook about the contrast of her mother and her friends in their fur coats and suede boots speaking of oppression, equality, and writes to a sad, resigned group of hard-working women in denim aprons, their hands red with chilblains. From the factory, the ladies would move on to the tea room on the Plaza de Armas, where they would stop for tea and pastry and discuss the progress of their campaign, not for a moment letting this frivolous distraction divert them from their flaming ideals. At other times, her mother would take her to the slums on the outskirts of the city, or to the tenements, where they arrived with their car piled high with food and with clothes that Nivea and her friends sewed for the poor. On these occasions, too, the child wrote with formidable intuition that charity had no effect on such monumental injustice. Her relationship to her mother was close and cheerful, and Nivea, despite having given birth to 15 children, treated Clara as if she were an only child, creating a tie so strong that it continued into succeeding generations as a family tradition. Nana had become an ageless woman, still in full possession of all the strength of her younger years. She was still able to leap out of corners hoping to scare the child's muteness away, just as she could spend the entire day standing over the hellfire in the center of the third courtyard, pushing an enormous stick around in the copper pot, where she bubbled the thick topaz-colored quince jam that, once cooled, Nivea delivered in molds of all shapes and sizes to the poor. Accustomed to living surrounded by children, Nana turned all her tenderness to Clara after the others left home. Even though the child was by now too old for it, she bathed her as if she were a baby, dousing her in the enameled tub with water scented with jasmine and basil, rubbing her with a sponge, soaping her meticulously without missing the least chink of ear or foot, massaging her with cologne and powdering her with a swan's down puff, and brushing her hair with infinite patience until it was as soft and shiny as an underwater plant. She dressed her, put her to bed, brought her breakfast on a tray, and forced her to drink linden tea for her nerves, chamomile for her stomach, lemon for translucent skin, rue for bile, and mint for her breath, until the child became a beautiful angelic being who walked through the halls and patios wrapped in a scent of flowers, a rustling of starched petticoats, and a halo of curls and ribbons. Clara's childhood came to an end, and she entered her youth within the walls of her house in a world of terrifying stories and calm silences. It was a world in which time was not marked by calendars or watches, and objects had a life of their own, in which apparitions sat at the table and conversed with human beings. The past and the future formed part of a single unit, and the reality of the present was a kaleidoscope of jumbled mirrors where everything and anything could happen. It is a delight for me to read her notebooks from those years, which describe a magic world that no longer exists. Clara lived in a universe of her own invention, protected from life's inclement weather, where the prosaic truth of material objects mingled with the tumultuous reality of dreams, and the laws of physics and logic did not always apply. Clara spent this time wrapped in her fantasies, accompanied by the spirits of the air, the water, and the earth. For 9 years, she was so happy that she felt no need to speak. Everyone had lost all hope of hearing her voice again, when on her birthday, after blowing out the 19 candles on her chocolate cake, she tried out the voice that she had kept in storage all those years, and that sounded like an untuned instrument. "I'm going to be married soon," she said.
"To whom?"
Severo asked.
"To Rosa's fiancé," Clara replied.
Only then did they realize she had spoken for the first time in all those years. The miracle shook the house to its foundations and set the whole family weeping. They called each other on the telephone. Word went out across the city, and they summoned Dr. Cuevas, who could not believe the news. In the uproar about Clara's regaining her voice, they all forgot what she had said, and they did not remember until 2 months later, when Esteban Trueba, whom they had not seen since Rosa's funeral, showed up at the door to ask for Clara's hand. Esteban Trueba alighted in the station and carried his two suitcases himself. The iron cupola the British had built in imitation of Victoria Station in the days when they had the concession to the national railways had not changed at all since the last time he had been there several years before. The same dirty windows, the same little shoeshine boys, the same women selling biscuits and candies, and the same porters with their dark caps bearing the insignia of the British crown, which no one had thought to replace with the colors of the national flag. He hailed a carriage and gave his mother's address. The city looked unfamiliar. There was a jumble of modernity, a myriad of women showing their bare calves and men in vests and pleated pants, an uproar of workers drilling holes in the pavement, knocking down trees to make room for telephone poles, knocking down telephone poles to make room for buildings, knocking down buildings to plant trees. A blockade of itinerant vendors hawking the wonders of this grindstone, the toasted peanut, this little doll that dances by itself without a single wire or thread. Look for yourself. Run your hand over it. A whirlwind of garbage dumps, food stands, factories, cars hurtling into carriages and sweat-drawn trolleys, as they called the old horses that hauled the municipal transport. A heavy breathing of crowds, a sound of running, of scurrying this way and that, of impatience and schedules. Esteban felt oppressed by it. He hated the city much more than he had remembered. He recalled the open meadows of the countryside, days clogged by the fall of rain, the vast solitude of his fields, the cool quiet of the river and his silent house. "This city is a shithole," he concluded. The carriage trotted toward the house where he had grown up. He shuddered at how badly the neighborhood had declined over the years, ever since the rich had decided to move their houses farther up the hill from everyone else, and the city had expanded into the foothills of the Cordillera. There was not a trace of the square where he had played as a little boy. It was now an empty lot filled with carts from the market that were parked among piles of garbage where stray dogs rummaged. His house was a ruin. He saw all the signs of the passage of time. On the rickety old-fashioned stained glass door, with its motifs of exotic birds, there was a bronze knocker in the shape of a woman's hand pressing on a ball. He knocked and waited what seemed like an interminable while until the door was open with a tug on a string that ran from the doorknob to the top of the stairs. His mother lived on the second floor and rented out the first floor to a button factory. Esteban began to climb the creaky steps, which had not been waxed in a long time. An ancient servant, whose existence he had completely forgotten, stood waiting for him on the landing and embraced him tearfully, just as she had greeted him at 15, when he came home from working at the notary office where he earned his living, copying property transfers and powers of attorney. Nothing had changed. Not even the placement of the furniture. But everything struck him as different. The hallways with their worn wood floors, the broken window panes patched with scraps of cardboard, the dusty ferns languishing in rusty tin cans and chipped ceramic pots, the fetid smells of urine mixed with food that turned his stomach. What poverty, Esteban thought. He wondered what on earth his sister did with all the money he sent her so that she could live in dignity. Férula came out to meet him with a sad grimace of welcome. She was greatly changed. She was no longer the opulent woman he had left years ago. She had lost weight, and her nose seemed enormous on her angular face. She gave off an aura of melancholy and bewilderment, a scent of lavender and old clothes. They embraced in silence. "How's Mama?" Esteban asked. "Come see. She's waiting for you," Férula replied. They walked down a corridor of connecting rooms, each identical to the next, dark and small, with tomb-like walls, high ceilings, and narrow windows, their wallpaper of discolored flowers and languid maidens stained from the soot of the coal stoves, and the patina of time and poverty. From far away, they could hear the voice of a radio announcer singing the praises of Dr. Ross's pills, tiny but effective against constipation, insomnia, and bad breath. They stopped outside the closed door of the bedroom of Doña Esther Trueba. "Here she is," said Férula. Esteban opened the door. It was several seconds before he could see in the darkness. The smell of medicine and decay hit him in the face, a sweetish odor of sweat, dampness, confinement, and something else that at first he could not quite identify, but that quickly stuck to him like a plague. The smell of decomposing flesh. A thread of light leaked through the window, which was ajar, and he was able to make out the wide bed in which his father had died and his mother had slept every night since she was married. It was carved in black wood, with a canopy of angels in relief and a few scraps of red brocade that were frayed with age. His mother was propped up in a half-seated position. She was a block of solid flesh, a monstrous pyramid of fat and rags that came to a point in a tiny bald head with a pair of eyes that were sweet, blue, innocent, and surprisingly alive. Arthritis had transformed her into a monolithic being. She could no longer bend any of her joints or turn her head. Her fingers were clawed like the feet of a fossil, and in order to sit up in bed, she had to be supported by a pillow at her back, held in place by a wooden beam that, in turn, was propped against the wall. The passage of time could be read by the marks the beam had cut into the plaster. A path of suffering, a trail of pain.
"Mama,"
Esteban murmured, and his voice broke in his chest, exploding into a contained sobbing that erased in a single stroke his sad memories, the rancid smells, frozen mornings, and greasy soup of his impoverished childhood. His invalid mother and absent father, and the rage that had been gnawing at him ever since the day he first learned how to think, so that he forgot everything except those rare, luminous moments in which this unknown woman, who now lay before him in her bed, had rocked him in her arms, felt his forehead for fever, sung him lullabies, bent over to read the pages of a favorite book with him, had wept with grief to see him leave for work so early in the morning when he was still a boy, wept with joy when he returned at night, had wept, "Mother, for me." Doña Esther reached out her hand, but not in greeting. The gesture was intended to hold him back.
"Don't come any closer, son,"
she said, and her voice was still intact, just as he remembered it, the healthy, song-like voice of a young girl. "It's because of the smell," Férula said brusquely. "It clings." Esteban pulled back the threadbare damask quilt and saw his mother's legs. They were two bruised elephantine columns covered with open wounds in which the larvae of flies and worms had made their nests and were busy tunneling, two legs rotting alive, with two outsized pale blue feet with no nails on the toes. Full to bursting with the pus, the black blood, and the abominable animals that were feeding on her flesh, mother, in God's name, of my own flesh.
"The doctor wants to amputate them, darling," Doña Esther said in her calm little girl voice. "But I'm too old for that. I'm tired of suffering. It's time for me to die. But I didn't want to die without seeing you again, because after all these years, I began to think that you were dead, and that perhaps your sister was writing your letters to spare me that additional pain. Come into the light, son, so I can get a good look at you. My God, you look like a savage."
"It's country life, Mama," he murmured.
"Finally. You still look strong. How old are you now?"
35.
"A good age to get married and settle down, so I can die in peace."
"You're not going to die, Mama," Esteban begged.
"I want to know that I'll have grandchildren, someone to carry on our name, with our blood in his veins. Férula has given up all hope of marrying, but
but you must find yourself a wife, a decent Christian woman. But first, you'd better cut your hair and shave your beard. Do you hear me?"
Esteban nodded. He knelt beside his mother and buried his face in her swollen hand. But the stench threw him back. Férula took him by the arm and led him out of that afflicted room. Once outside, he inhaled deeply, the smell still clinging to his nostrils, and it was then he felt the rage he knew so well, that rose to his head like a blazing wave, injecting his eyes and bringing a pirate's curse to his lips. Rage at all the time he had gone without thinking of his mother. Rage at having let her go uncared for, at not having loved her and cared for her enough, at being a miserable son of a bitch. "No, forgive me, mother. That's not what I meant to say. Jesus, she's dying. She's an old woman, and I can't do a damned thing. Not even ease her pain. Alleviate the decay. Get rid of that terrifying stench, that death soup in which you were boiling alive, mother." 2 days later, Doña Esther Trueba died in the bed of pain where she had spent the final years of her life. She was alone, because her daughter Férula had gone, as she did every Friday, to the tenements in the Misericordia district to say the rosary for the poor, the atheists, the prostitutes, and the orphans who threw garbage at her, dumped chamber pots onto her, and spat on her while she, kneeling in the desolate slum alleyway, shouted an unbroken litany of Our Fathers and Hail Marys as she dripped with the slop of the poor, the spit of atheists, the garbage of prostitutes, and the refuse of orphans, weeping her lament of humiliation, begging forgiveness for those who know not what they do, and feeling that her bones were turning to rubber, her legs to cotton, and that a summer heat was pressing sin between her thighs. "Take from me this chalice, Lord," that her groin was bursting into hellfire, flames of fear, of holiness. "I, Our Father, don't let me fall into temptation, Jesus." Esteban was not with Doña Esther either when she died quietly in her bed of pain. He had gone to see the Del Valle family to inquire if they might still have an unmarried daughter, because after so many years of absence and barbarism, he knew of nowhere else to begin to keep his promise to his mother of giving her legitimate grandchildren. And he concluded that if Severo and Nivia had accepted him as a prospective son-in-law back in the days of Rosa the Beautiful, there was no reason they should refuse him, especially now that he was a rich man and no longer needed to scrape the earth for gold and had everything he needed on deposit at the bank. That night, Esteban and Férula found their mother dead in bed. She was smiling peacefully, as if at the last moment of her life, her illness had wished to spare her its familiar torture. The day Esteban Trueba asked to be received, Severo and Nivia del Valle remembered the words with which Clara had broken her lengthy silence. Thus, they were not the least surprised when their visitor asked if they had any daughters of marriageable age and condition. They tallied things up, telling him that Ana had become a nun, Teresa was very ill, and all the others were already married, except for Clara, the youngest, who was still available, although she was a rather eccentric creature, not particularly well suited to the duties of marriage and domestic life. With all due honesty, they told him of their daughter's traits, without omitting the fact that she had spent more than half her lifetime without speaking because she did not feel like it, and not because she was unable to, as the Romanian Rostipov had made quite clear, and as Dr. Cuevas had confirmed after innumerable examinations. But Esteban Trueba was not the kind of man to let himself be scared away by tales of ghosts in hallways, objects that move of their own accord, or prognostications of bad luck, much less by Clara's prolonged silence, which he considered a virtue. He concluded that none of these things posed any obstacle to bringing healthy, legitimate children into the world, and he asked to be introduced to Clara. Nivia went out to fetch her daughter, and the two men were left alone in the drawing room, an occasion that Trueba, with characteristic candor, took advantage of to present his economic position.
"Please, Esteban, one thing at a time,"
Severo interrupted him. First, you have to see the girl and get to know her a little. And then we also have to consider Clara's wishes, don't you think?